You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Bob Huggins is one of six NCAA men's college basketball coaches to reach 900 career victories, reaching that total during the NCAA tournament last March. He's one of two coaches to earn at least 300 victories at two different schools, and he led both of those schools, Cincinnati and West Virginia, to Final Four appearances. For some crazy reason, he is not yet in the Hall of Fame, something that needs to change as soon as possible. I got to know Coach during his one season at Kansas State, where I learned to appreciate his commitment to excellence and his sense of humor. His public persona may be that of a gruff guy, but I could tell you he's a man who cares deeply and is a friend to many, and I consider it a privilege to be counted in that latter group. Coach, welcome to Sports Connections.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, my first recollection of you, at least in person, was when you accepted the head coaching position at Kansas State in 2006. One of the media members asked you about the rivalry between K-State and Kansas, and you quickly said it wasn't a rivalry because K-State wasn't a threat. And then you said it was your mission to change that. And I was impressed right away, and I know my fellow media members were as well. And that really speaks to your competitiveness. Just talk about your competitiveness, where that comes from, and how that drives you.
Well, I've always admired John Kennedy said when they asked him to run for vice president because he was young, aristocratic, and Catholic. He said, "Why settle for second when first is available?" I've tried to live my life that way.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, why would you settle? I mean, why don't you try to be the best?
Yeah. The other recollection I have of that first year, there's a lot, obviously, but the other one that just sticks in my mind was after your first game. K-State opened against William & Mary, a team they should have defeated, which you guys did, but you didn't win by as many points as you should have. And I remember you wore a purple suit to that game. And after the game, in the media room, we were talking about your bad mood. You said you were in a bad mood because of your team's play. And someone asked you, if you were in a good mood before the game and you said, "I wore this suit, didn't I?" And then Mark Jansen, the sports editor of the local paper, said, "Did you get that suit at JCPenney?" And deadpan, you looked at him and said, "JCPenney is for people like you, Mark." And it was then that we discovered your sense of humor. Where does that come from?
I have no idea.
Have you always been funny?
I enjoy life, you know.
Yeah. So
I don't know. My dad, I don't think my dad was particularly funny. My mom was actually pretty shy. I don't know. I guess when you do what I do and you get asked as many questions as I get asked, and, you know, and all due respect, the stupid questions at times that I get asked, I guess you just kind of, after a while, you kind of respond to the first thing that pops in your head. And sometimes the first thing that pops in my head is sometimes funny anyway.
Sarcasm, maybe. I tell people I'm bilingual. My second language is sarcasm. Would that fit you?
I would say I'm pretty sarcastic, yeah.
Actually, I tell people I'm never sarcastic and let them figure that one out. Is sense of humor necessary to be a college basketball coach these days?
No, I don't think so. A lot of guys don't have much of a sense of humor, but the ones that do are a lot more fun to be around. I've been on the phone with Andy Kennedy, who was my assistant at Cincinnati and a coach at Ole Miss, a head coach at Ole Miss, and now the head coach at UAB. And there is not a funnier human being in basketball, period, as Andy Kennedy. He is hilarious, and he just got, and it's never stops. It's whether you're in a 1-point game, a tie game with 2 seconds to go, or you're in practice, or you're just riding to go see a recruit. He is absolutely hilarious.
But Coach, sometimes the humor is in the delivery. I mean, had you said that to Mark Jansen, I don't know if you remember saying that, but had you said that with a big smile on your face or something like that, it wouldn't have been as funny as the deadpan look. And nobody laughed harder than Mark, by the way. He was not offended. And we all thought, this is going to be fun, because we saw the deadpan. I, as you know, I did a book recently with Joe Lunardi, And I, at the Big 12 Media Day, before that book came out, I interviewed a lot of coaches, including you, about your opinions of bracketology. And the one I was looking forward to the most was Shaka Smart, because Shaka had said after he was, when he was at VCU and they were in the first four and made the final four, he had famously said, I hope Joe Lunardi puts us out of his, you know, out of his tournament on his bubble every year because it's good luck for us. So I saw Shaka, I walked up to him and I said, so what do you think of bracketology? He goes, oh, I never pay any attention to it whatsoever. And so we had in that chapter about people's reactions, we had, we did them alphabetically. So right after Bill Self talks about how great it is and how, you know, he looks at it, not so much to see if they're in, but to see who they might be playing, stuff like that, is Shaka Smart saying, I don't pay any attention whatsoever. So it's delivery, it's setting as much as anything. So I crack up every time I'm around you. And many times, you know, it's not, you're not cracking jokes. You're just deadpanning things. Does that make sense?
Well, my best friend for many, many years who we unfortunately lost way too early was Charlie Spoonhour. And there was, there was, never has been a basketball coach funnier than Spoon was.
Yeah.
And I mean, we were together. I look back at it. I don't know how either one of us found time to spend the time together that we did.
Yeah.
It was like if someone called and said, hey, can you come over here and speak? It's like, who's going to be there? Well, I was hoping you could get Spoon to go. I said, well, Spoon will go, I'll go.
Yeah.
And then vice versa. So we ended up all over the place. I mean, yeah. we ended up in, where were we? Philadelphia. I think it was Philadelphia when Calipari was doing a fundraiser for something. And he had John Chaney was there and John had handcuffs on and all that. And Spoon got up and just, I mean, absolutely the place went crazy. We did a deal in Missouri one time and his buddy, the Budweiser guy, I mean, and for a reason, Spoon always had buddies that were Budweiser guys. and he got up and I mean, he was struggling and I kept hitting Spoon saying, man, you got to go save him. You got to go save him. He said, ah, he's fine. Spoon got up and couldn't have talked 10 minutes. And had the place people falling out of their chairs. and he walked over, sit down, and he said, "All right, Junior, it's your turn now." And that's kind of the way it always was. He was, I loved the guy. I mean, yeah. he was very, very near and dear to me and was one heck of a basketball coach on top of being funny.
And he was a great announcer. He obviously late in his time, he became a broadcaster and he was, because that sense of humor came out. It wasn't forced. It just came out. So I'm glad you brought him up. I want to talk about something that's not as much fun. Does it bother you as much as it bothers us, those of us who are your fans, that you're not in the Hall of Fame?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't bother me.
Really?
No.
You don't sit there and think, I won 900 games. You know, I've, all those things that we read in the introduction, you don't think, what do I have to do?
Well, if it wasn't for guys like you, I wouldn't have a clue how many games I've won or lost. I generally know how many I lose, but I don't really pay attention to how many we win. No, it doesn't bother me. I mean, it's not why I do what I do. It's not why I've done it this long. I enjoy the camaraderie that coaches have. I enjoy being around the players and watching them grow up and mature. You know, I enjoy the fact that they call quite frequently during the course of the year, if not to, you know, talk about a game they watched on television, about what they're doing with their life or their children or their job or, and to me, that's what it's about. I mean, it's not about whether you're in the Hall of Fame or not, or you know, whether you're Coach of the Year or not. It's about the relationships that you have. And I mean, we have a great profession because, you know, we all, contrary to what some people think, we basically all do get along.
Yeah.
You know, we all do care about each other, and we care about our guys. We care about the people who play for us, and we want them to go on and be extremely successful.
Now, so I got to ask you, that day is coming, Coach. I'm telling you, it's every year for the last several years, you hear a little bit, well, how come Bob Huggins isn't in there? For some reason this year, when the results were announced, or when it was announced who was going to get in and your name was not on that list, there was uproar like I've never seen before. And I have a feeling it's going to come very soon. So when you get that call, or if you have to give a speech, are you going to say, oh, thanks a lot, this doesn't mean anything to me? How are you going to react when you do get that call?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it. I really haven't thought about it. I don't pay attention to it. I don't. And that's not a slap at the hall or, right, or the people who run it. I just, that's not me. I tell you what I would hope that I would be able to do is say what Spoon would have said. And then that way everybody walks out saying, man, that was really neat what he said. And you don't make anybody mad, you know, and everybody walks out in a good mood. And that's what I loved about Spoon. If you were around Spoon, you walked out chuckling to yourself in a great mood and feeling good about yourself. And hopefully, you know, I can, I'm never going to be Spoon for sure, but
yeah,
I've learned a lot from the guy.
So you're not going to spend your time when we get off today writing down notes for when that day comes or anything like that?
No.
Okay. I want to talk to you about Bob Huggins, the player. You were a pretty good collegiate player. I know you had a chance to play professionally. Would you have fit the Press Virginia program that you have created? Would Bob Huggins, the player, have been a good player for Bob Huggins, the coach?
Yeah, I think I would have. Because as a player, I understood the game. You know, I grew up around basketball. From the time I could pretty much walk and hold a ball, I went to practice with my dad. I'm not gonna lie and say I paid a lot of attention to what they were doing out there because I was over there trying to figure out how to make a shot. But I was very fortunate, you know, growing up. Being around my dad, for sure. My dad had the utmost respect for a guy named Ed McCluskey, Harold, Pennsylvania. And my dad would practice and come home and grab the sandwich and jump in a car and say, come on. And I would ride with him to Farrell, Pennsylvania, which wasn't around the corner. And I would sit and listen to my dad and coach talk about different things. And I've been blessed. I mean, I really have been blessed. I'm coaching at Walsh College. I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I knew that, you know, our first game, we had 36 people at the game and three Brotherhood of Christian Instruction. They came in with cardigan sweaters on. They weren't even wearing their collars, you know. And I went downstairs after the game. I'll never forget. I told Dan Peters, my assistant, I said, you know, before we leave here, we're going to pack this place and the brothers are going to come in wearing their collars. Both of those things happened, you know. So I've been blessed. I've been blessed to be around great basketball minds.
Did your coaching philosophy, the constant pressure, the using your whole roster, all those things that have become synonymous with your teams? In fact, I remember the first time at K-State, I said, you've used, you know, 12 players scored for you. And you kind of looked at me incredulously like, well, that's what you're supposed to do. You got these guys. I don't remember exactly what you said, but it was basically, you got that many guys on the roster. Why not use them? Did that philosophy come from your dad?
I think what I told you was that's all I had. I'd have had some more. I'd have got them in the game too.
If I had an eligibility, you'd have put me in there, huh?
Well, I'm not going to go that far.
Okay. Yeah.
No, not really. That didn't really No, that my dad's teams didn't play that. They were more half court. They guarded. They really guarded. But they it wasn't frantic. It wasn't full court. It wasn't taking the chances that we take.
So where did that come from?
Sitting watching film and trying to figure out how to win. We've never really played the same very, very often. I mean, we did the press Virginia thing because I had the best shot blocker in the country in Sagabaugh Kanate, and I had the best on the ball defender in Javon Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Why not take advantage of that?
But and I recognize that was a unique name for that particular team, but you have always, as long as I've been watching you, and I watched you some when you were at Cincinnati, but especially at K-State and in the years at West Virginia, it's always, if you're the opponent, it's always like you're playing 5-on-8 because there, it seems like anytime you beat one guy, there's somebody else right there. And that's probably pretty consistent, isn't it?
Seems like in the Big 12, we do play 5-on-8. They've just got three guys wearing a different uniform.
I don't want to get you in trouble, Coach. I will bring up another story that you and I share later on. But I want to get a straight answer if I can from you on the fact that you send defenders at the ball constantly to make it tough for the offense. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. You can't score without the ball. So you probably ought to guard the guy with the ball a little harder than you guard the guy who doesn't have the ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, we do. Of course we do.
Okay. I remember you brought it up. I'm going to try not to get you into trouble, but you brought up the guys in different uniforms than either of the teams playing on the court. And I remember being at a Big 12 semifinal game. KU was playing K-State, and KU is a better team. I recognize that, but I felt that the officiating was not fair. And you were sitting next to me scouting the game with one of your assistants, and I was giving you space. I wasn't trying to engage you. But at one point, and you had won the first semifinal, so you were scouting to see who you'd play in the championship game. And I looked over at you and I said, "Are you prepared to play 5-on-8 tomorrow?" And you went off. You said, "Oh, I mean, you talked about the game in Lawrence where it was like 30-3 and fouls." And you went on for like 2 or 3 minutes. And finally, I reached over and picked up my little recorder. And I said, "Good thing this isn't turned on." And you, the look on your face went, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "It's okay, Coach. your secret is safe." I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't know or don't recognize about you is that you are an engaging person. You're not afraid to talk about anything. I said at the beginning, you have the public persona of being a gruff guy, but you really are engaging with people and you like to visit, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, I try to visit and help those three guys in the wrong uniforms. I try to visit and be very engaging with them throughout the course of the game.
Uh-huh.
Thinking that, you know, with all of my years of expertise, I might be able to help them.
That doesn't go well very often, does it?
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. Some of them actually do listen.
Yeah. Okay. I want to go back to your 1 year at Kansas State. Like a lot of K-State fans, I think you deserve a credit for restoring the program. The years before, and I don't want you to disparage, and I'm not going to disparage the coaches who preceded you, but K-State basketball is almost an afterthought. And in your 1 year, you turned the program into a significant program, somebody that had to be reckoned with. And obviously Frank took it and ran with it. Just talk about your 1 year at K-State and how it rejuvenated your career. Because you were off for a year before that year. Just talk about that year.
Well, I think the story that's not been told is I was offered 2 NBA jobs in the year that I was off.
Really?
So, yeah. And I just didn't think that it was the right place at the right time. And I honestly didn't think K-State was until I had the opportunity to talk to Tim Weiser and the opportunity to talk to John Weifold. Then all of a sudden, you know, everything started to fall into place. I loved it there. I mean, I loved it there. I loved the people. I couldn't have worked for any better people than what I worked for. Frank loved it there, you know, and honestly, I mean, we all were, I think, a little guarded.
Yeah.
And I said to Frank, I said to Delonte, of course, Brad already knew, but I said to those guys, I said, wait till you talk to the people. When you talk to the people, you'll realize why I'm excited about this. And the people were fantastic, absolutely fantastic, and continue to be. I can remember doing a Cadbacker thing. I don't know where we were, somewhere. And so, you know, I'm talking about we're going to build a program, we're going to win, which all eventually happened. And a guy said, and probably justifiably so, he said, I've heard this before. He said, why would I buy the tickets to continue on with where we are? I said, I'll tell you what, let's do it. I'll buy your tickets. You know, if you're upset, I'll buy your tickets. And then I'll make sure you can't get any the next year. When everybody's trying to get tickets.
Yeah.
And he came up to me afterwards and he said, I'm sold. I'll buy the tickets. So, you know, I mean, it's, we forget sometimes. I mean, we're just people talking to people.
Yeah.
You know, and I think sometimes we forget that. But I tell you what, the thing that I have the utmost respect for Coach Snyder, and we were practicing and we got after it pretty good. And Coach and Jim Colbert are standing over in a tunnel. And so I walked over, I said, you know, come on in. I mean, Coach, I'd love to have you anytime you want to come to practice, whatever. You know, and obviously Jim Colbert, and they sit up there and they watch practice. And after, I don't know how long it was or how many practices, but Coach said to me, he said, you know, your group reminds me of the group I brought in, and which was legendary, the Stoops guys and Mangino. And I think there were probably five or six or maybe, I don't know, seven, yeah, eight, that were high major head football coaches that Coach brought into to K-State and on his staff that, yep, built the football program at K-State. And he said the same thing about Frank and Brad and Delonte. And look where they are now.
Yeah.
And Coach was 100% right. And you know, I wish I could foresee the future like Coach has, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I admire the guy. I just think he's a special, special guy that he's a credit to our business, I guess.
And he talks often. I know him really well. I've written several books on his program. But he talks often about the people of Kansas State, you know, the family of Kansas State. And that's really what you're talking about. It's not just the people who buy tickets. It's the people who really invest in your program. Is that correct?
Oh, without a question. Yeah. You couldn't have a better AD than what Tim Weiser was. You certainly couldn't have a better president than what Dr. Weifold was. And Bob Krause. And I mean, you go right, Casey Scott, you go right through. I mean, they just had quality people in positions and they wanted to help you. It wasn't like, you know, you go down the hallway and they're trying to shut their doors because you go in and, you know, and they know the reason you came down the hallway is you want something. And they were so helpful. They were so accommodating. And they cared so much, you know, and I think to me, that's it. I mean, I think when you have a team, players that care, when you have a coaching staff that cares, you're on the right track. You're going to be pretty good.
You left after 1 year, and I understand why you left. You went home. And I'm sure there's still a few people that are upset. It's been 14 years. There's a few people that were upset that you left after 1 year with what was starting to build. But talk about going home. and the fact that you played at West Virginia, you grew up in Morgantown. Just talk about the pull that that had. And then does it seem like it's been 14 years since you've been back?
Well, those people that are upset ought to get over it. I mean, I left them Mike Beasley. I left them Bill Walker. Yeah. I left them the all-time leading scorer in the school's history.
Yeah,
I left them the defensive player of the year in the Big 12. I mean, come on. Get over. I left them one heck of a coach that, you know, I could have taken those guys with me. In fact, I had to talk them into staying. And actually, you know, I had a long conversation with Dr. Weifold, who trusted me and trusted the fact that I believed that much in what Frank could do and Delonte could do and Brad could do. So they need to get over it because, I mean, I could have taken those guys. How about if I bring them here with the guys that were already here and the guys that we were recruiting there, the DeJuan Blairs and those people who decided they didn't want to go that far away from home. So, yeah, I mean, it was the right thing to do at the right time. And it was my last chance to come home. They had offered me the job before. I didn't take it. This was it. This was my last opportunity to come home. People don't realize I was born here.
Yeah.
My mother and father grew up here. My mom, if you'll walk out of this building and you head towards campus, the first road on the left is 8th Street. My mother lived in the first house up on the hill at 8th Street. My dad grew up in Dug Hill. That's suburban Saberton, for those who don't know.
Okay. Does it seem like it's been 14 years?
No, it really doesn't.
Has it been, you know, and this is kind of, I think I have to be careful how I ask this and you have to be careful how you answer it. Has it been what you hoped and thought it would be?
I don't know what I thought it would be, to be honest with you. I knew that there were great fans here. I knew how much the people in the state of West Virginia cherishes their football, their basketball teams, their athletic teams. I knew all that. I went to the athletic director and I said, Eddie, things haven't changed a lot here. We need to make some changes. I mean, we still had phys ed on the Coliseum floor. We still had women's volleyball. We had women's basketball. We had gymnastics. We had wrestling. When do we get to squeeze in there? You know, and I said, we need to build a practice facility. And he said, you're right. You're absolutely right. I said, so you're okay with building one? He said, yeah. He said, let me show you where we're going to build it. And he walked over. I'm sitting in a practice facility right now. He walked over. He said, we're going to build it right here, Bobby. I said, you're going to build it right here, Eddie? He said, as soon as you raise the money.
I hate to sound cliche, but has it been almost heaven?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, it really has.
On a personal note, I know we talked about this before we started recording. I know you lost your dad recently, and I lost my dad a number of years ago, and I still think about him often. I mean, he's been gone for 16 years. Talk about the impact that your dad had on your life. Not just in coaching, but include your decision to get into coaching.
You know, I think a lot of guys when they give speeches, talks, whatever, address their coaches about what an influence they had on their life. Well, I got a 24/7. You know, I mean, they're only getting a couple hours a day. I got a 24/7. So he had a tremendous impact on my life. He coached me. I was his partner. You know, when he went to see Coach McCluskey, when he went to scout games, when I was the oldest, and it was always, come on, Bobby, let's go. You know, so I spent a lot more time around him than what obviously my brothers and sisters did. My dad had a great quote in the paper. They asked him, how many children do you have? He said, 3 boys and 4 others. He coached the boys' basketball team, not the women's.
So you have 4 sisters. How do they feel about that quote?
They weren't very happy.
Yeah.
For some reason, they took offense to it.
Yeah, imagine that. Was it assumed that you would be a coach, or did that happen after your playing opportunity ended?
No, I tried to be. I tried out just about everything. I was going to be a doctor, and then I was going to be a lawyer, and I was going to be a lot of different things. And I didn't really know what I wanted to be, where I wanted to go. I just kind of floated around for a while, and then I started to enjoy the coaching part of it, the strategy part of it. You know, I just wanted to be a player.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really care about the other stuff. I just wanted to be a player.
All right. I always like to let my guests share 2 things, and you've seen the questions, so you know. The first one is to talk about your family.
Well, I'm blessed. I'm blessed that I have 2 brothers that both were major college basketball players. So you have someone to confide in that has been and done what you do. Neither one went into coaching. I've got 4 sisters who are terrific. You turn on a Mountaineer game, you're going to see my brothers and my sisters at the game. So I've got a very, I think, unique and supportive family atmosphere that, which is another reason, you know, why being here as opposed to being in Manhattan, Kansas, made a big difference. And it's not easy for them. I mean, they drive 2.5 hours to every game.
Yeah.
And then turn around and drive back. It's not easy. It's not like I'm the only one living in West Virginia. We moved. I was about 3rd grade, I think, when we moved to Ohio. So my sisters really are, they're Ohioans.
Okay.
I think the 3 boys, I think, are kind of favor West Virginia a little bit more.
Okay. And wife, kids?
Yeah, I've got 2 great girls. 2 terrific girls that really, you talk about didn't want to move from Cincinnati. I mean, they love Cincinnati, the 2 girls. And you know, my wife's terrific. I mean, she, wherever I've thought was in our best interest, she jumped right on board. She loved Manhattan, Kansas. She says to this day that her favorite place that we've ever lived is Manhattan, Kansas. She loved the people. She loved the small town. She loved everything about it.
I remember when I talked to you, this has probably been 3 or 4 years ago, and I told you about our coaches ministry, and it was for coaches and spouses. And you seemed very interested. And then I said, we're going to have a forum in there where the wives can talk about their husbands. And you said, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I'm out. I don't need a forum for my wife to share her share her thoughts about me. But she is a supportive. I don't know her. I'm sure I've met her. But Lenardi says, behind every good man is a surprised woman. Just talk about her support of you in your coaching role.
Well, why would I want to go to a forum and listen to her when I get to do that every day for nothing? I don't have to travel anywhere or anything else.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that's true. We play a game, we go home, we rewatch the game. It's not easy on coaches' wives. We travel a lot. You know, we with the recruiting and the team travel and everything else, the speaking things that we do, it's rough. I mean, I fully understand how rough it is. And,
yeah.
But that's, you know, they're so good with the kids, you know, but they have to be.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of times we're not around.
Yeah. And then the question I always like to let everybody finish, and I say, you can answer this, you can interpret the question and answer it however you want. What is your legacy?
Hopefully that I cared. Hopefully that I cared about, the place that I was at. I cared about the people, and most importantly, cared about the players, that they know that I'm going to be there for them today, tomorrow, or 10 years from now.
It's very rarely do I get a response that basically reiterates what I said in my introduction, but I said, those of us who know him know that he's a man who cares deeply. So I'm glad to hear you emphasize that. And I think it's true. I've met a few of your players through the years, and they know that you care about them. And not just that they can dribble the basketball or block a shot or play defense, but you care about them as people. And so that's really cool.
Let me share this with you. I went to the University of Akron, and I had a center who was a good player, big old guy, not tall, but big. And I hadn't talked to him in quite a while. And the times that we talked were, I had a player commit suicide because he had cancer. And, so I hadn't talked to him a lot, and he called, he said, Coach, he said, can I come down and spend some time with you? I said, yeah, man, come down and spend as much time with me as you want. And he said, well, can you, you know, help me get a hotel room? Or I said, no, you're going to stay at my house. And so he came down, and I think the first day was there, we had a game. And then the next day we practiced, and he came to practice. And I think then the next day we had a game. But we got to sit and talk, and you know, I asked him, you know, what could I have done better? And he was terrific, and stayed, I think, for one more day, one more practice, and then went back to Akron. 3 days later, he died. And, you know, I'm sitting there, did he know? You know, did he know? And, you know, I can't imagine that if he knew, he wanted to spend his last few days with me. Yeah. But you know, you just don't know. But it was, I mean, that hits you.
Oh, yeah.
You lose a game, and it's, you know, it's like we act like it's life and death. But when really a life and death situation happens, I mean, that really wakes you up.
Yeah, for sure. And to know that you had that impact on him, I'm guessing, and not knowing the story until just now, I'm guessing he may not have known it was going to happen 3 days later, but he knew it was coming. And that really says a lot about your impact on him, that he wanted to spend time with you.
Well, dude, I mean, I hope so. And I hope that it was what he wanted.
Yeah. Well, Coach, it's always good to catch up with you. I've enjoyed laughing with you. I don't know, maybe we shouldn't publish this if you don't want the word to get out how funny you are, but I've enjoyed laughing with you and catching up with you about the years we've known each other.
You know, I just you can't imagine how much I loved and admired Charlie Sponauer, because it didn't matter what was going on, he had everybody laughing, and he just made everybody feel better. And I loved the guy. I mean, he was the big brother that I never had, even though he came up to about my waist, but he was the big brother that I never had.
Well, I'll tell you what, Coach, when that call comes that you are in the Hall of Fame and we find out what night the induction ceremony is, I will be the guy heckling you from the back, but applauding and laughing at your deadpan jokes. But I plan to be there because I admire you tremendously. And I thank you for being here with us today.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smail. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smail and his work by visiting davidsmailbooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.